Today's Tesho will be on Case 37 in the Book of Serenity, Guishan's Active Consciousness. Introduction: driving away the plowman's ox, pulling its nose around, taking away the hungry man's food, holding his throat tight. Is there anyone who could administer the poison? Case: Guishan asked Yongshan, if someone suddenly said, all sentient beings have active consciousness, boundless and unclear, with no fundamental to rely on, how would you prove it in experience? Yongshan said, if a monk comes, I call him, hey you. If the monk turns his head, I say, what is it? If he hesitates, I say, not only is their active consciousness boundless and unclear, they have no fundamental to rely on. Guishan said, good. Verse. One call and he turns his head. Do you know the self or not? Vaguely, like the moon through ivy, a crescent at that. The child of riches, as soon as he falls on the boundless road of destitution, has such sorrow. Just to explain a little bit, koan. This line, Guishan asked Yongshan, if someone suddenly said, and then he quotes the Flower Ornament Sutra. So he quotes a line from the Flower Ornament Sutra. Guishan asked Yongshan, hey Yongshan, if somebody said this to you, how would you prove it in experience? And what the person would have said is, all sentient beings just have active consciousness, boundless and unclear, with no fundamental to rely on. How would you prove it? Longshan said, if a monk comes, I say to him, hey you. If the monk turns his head and says, what is it? If the monk turns his head, I say, what is it? If he hesitates, I say, not only is their active consciousness boundless and unclear, they have no fundamental to rely on. Guishan said to her. So today is officially day 4 of our May-June session. And everybody's been doing, last night people came into Dokusan and really it was obvious that people are doing wonderful practice. And same thing today. It's just deeply moving to be sitting with you. Everybody's made a wonderful effort and it's just wonderful. You know, I really like practicing the way we practice. This is a small group of people, relatively speaking. You can go to a meditation centers where there's 100 people at a session. And I think that has its virtues too, but one of the virtues of the practicing in a relatively small community like this is that I think it just gives the whole tone of the practice a different flavor, different quality. I just enjoy being able to work side by side with everybody else. And there's something about this like a community of friends practicing Zen. That's just wonderful, in my opinion. There isn't a lot of ritual there isn't a lot, there isn't a huge organization. And it's nice, actually, to be able to talk in Dokusan. You know, at some of these places, the teacher has so many people going through the Dokusan line that you really have to just go in, and it's just you're in and you're out. It's like going to the doctor, you know? You barely get to talk about why you're sick, and the guy's already showing you out the door to on to the next patient. You know, it's and really in those places that teacher has to function like that, because you just have to get people to move through. But it's nice to be able to talk and to find out what's actually happening with people's practice. And I personally like that a great deal. But I also just like this idea of like a community, a group of friends practicing Zen, you know, and I just think this is the ideal way to practice. And, I just love it. It's marvelous. And, you know, I trained in a place like that. You know, my teacher, Genki Roshi, had come from Daitokuji. That's where he did much of his formal training, which is this huge monastic institution, relatively speaking. And, you know, there's actually a number of sub-temples at the complex. So it's not just one temple. There's actually a number of temples in the Daitokuji complex. And it's a rather large enterprise. And, you know, my teacher really wanted to get away from that kind of thing. And so we practiced in Seattle at the Seattle Zen Center. You know, we knew each other. We sat day in and day out beside each other. And then we all went to Sesshin together a lot of the time. And I just think that's the best way to practice, you know. You have deep. I actually think that the friendships you form in Zen practice are very deep. You know, you're sitting with somebody wordlessly for 7 days or 5 days, and you know, they see you at your most unglamorous, right? You know, really, you know, and nobody has too much time to worry about his appearance in a setting like this, you know. It's more or less trying to stay alive, right? And people are quite unguarded. And also, you often see the best part of people. You know, if you practice Zen long enough, you actually are often at your best when things are not going very well. You know, that's one of the wonderful things about this path, is that, you know, if people stay on it long enough, you know, most people, when they're in pain, become, a lot of people, not everybody, it's not true, I shouldn't have said most, but it's often the case that when people are in pain, they become rather petty or fearful, angry, all the things we confront in ourselves on the cushion, you know. But if you practice Zen long enough, you work through all that, and often when you're in pain, you're very kind. You know, you're very patient and giving, and you know, it's nice to be around people like that, or people who want to be like that. And so, there's something very precious about, I think, this kind of a community of friends, all on the road of Dharma together, all practicing the way, and it's just very precious, you know, really wonderful. I think people have been doing so well in their practice because basically we've gone through a number of days that were difficult, you know, that were hard. It's easy to there's a famous saying that in Zen that goes like this: everybody wants to talk about the great Zen master, but nobody wants to talk about the sweating horses of the past. And that was a famous saying from the Tang Dynasty, when there were these great Zen masters. And everybody wanted to talk about Joshu. Who's greater, Joshu or Linji or Wangbo or Baijiang? And one of them said, yeah, everybody wants to talk about Linji and Wangbo, but nobody wants to talk about all those monks and nuns who were just sitting with pain in their legs day after day trying to understand enlightened mind. They made it possible for a Linji or a Wangbo or a Zhaozhu to appear in this world. And I think that's a very important insight. And a related insight is that, you know, we become a Joshu or Linji by around day 4 of a Sesshin. You know, we become more like them because we've been sweating like horses on the cushion, you know. And that element of Zen is not a misfortune or a distraction from practice. It's an essential part of the practice. You know, there is a strong element in Zen practice of what we could call purification. A lot of Zen practice at a sesshin is purification of body, mind, and heart. We say transpiration if we want to say it, but I think purification is a better word because it's a little bit like we have to work through some problems that we've created. You know, the truth is that when we come to sesshin, we're like people who are patients at a hospital, so, you know, and we're here to sort of get healthy. And that's the truth, you know. And so there's a kind of process we have to go through, which is difficult, but it's health restoring. And it's difficult therapy though, you know, because you have to really sweat bullets on the cushion. And it's partly difficult because of the way we live a lot of the time. In other words, you know, at sesshin we have a life which puts awakened mind or mu shin at the center of our lives. And we don't particularly live lives of the sesshin of, you know, selfishness, aggression, and so on and so on. Everybody in the modern world who comes to sesshin is going to feel a little bit of a jolt, and it's a bit of a sacrifice, and it's a bit of a shock because we just don't live this kind. Typically, modern people just don't live this way. You know, I think that there was a time when people lived very simple and austere lives. And they knew hard work and privation all the time. And I wouldn't want to live that in that situation myself. I like being able to go to the grocery store and find oranges in the winter, you know. In fact, one of my second teacher's friends was a Tibetan, and he came to the United States and started a temple in Seattle. And one of the things that used to just blow his mind was going to the grocery store. He had grown up in Tibet, and then he had fled during the communist takeover of Tibet. And then he had lived in Dharamsala under very austere circumstances because the Tibetan emigre community was very poor at one time. And so he came to Seattle and he went to the Safeway, you know. It's the grocery store we have out there. And there's like as many oranges as you can see. You know, it's just like everywhere you look, one part of the store is just oranges. There might be a million oranges there. You know, and then you look over, and there's bags of potatoes up to the sky and things like this. And he said he was astounded. He said, you know, in Tibet there was never enough to eat. You know, it's just that was all, you know, you always just ate sparingly because you knew, you know, he didn't, there wouldn't be a meal tomorrow. And he was just blown away. He loved it. By the way, he didn't hate it. He loved it. He just thought, you know, in fact, he enjoyed just going to the grocery store, you know, just walking around and enjoying the sheer abundance of it. And you know, this is you know how we live, you know, and so you know this it's good and it's bad, you know, it has its good and its bad parts, but you know basically we don't live like Sesshin, generally speaking, and you know we get caught up in kind of like the collective consciousness of our society, and you know the society constantly encourages you to be worried, fearful, envious, anxious, and so on. It's just, it's inevitably so, you know. You know, it's a constant sort of conditioning from the culture. There's the news, for example, you know, has to find something to get you worried. If it's not an effective news story if you're not worried, right? And so they've got to make it look like the end of the world could happen, and you know you need this information. And so if you listen to the news, it's like, oh my gosh, you know, the end of the world, it's going to be the end of the world. You know? You're constantly sort of on edge. And of course, you know, just driving on the roads in New Jersey, it's hard not to fall into like savage self-assertiveness, right? You know? So you know, it's just a fact. You know? People on our jobs are not always nice to us. They're not always kind. Some people are dishonest. If you're in business, for example, you know, people are constant. Fraud is a constant danger. You know, my brother was a businessman, and he was constantly in court. People would perpetuate some fraud. You know, like he'd get a delivery and. You know, he'd count the items and they weren't all list, you know, they didn't match the manifest, the invoice. And, you know, there'd be an argument and he'd have to go to court and litigate. And he said, it gets so tiresome dealing with this, you know, sort of dishonesty. And, so this is the world we live in, right? You know, it's a world of confusion and anger and so on. And we pick it up, you know, sort of through cultural osmosis as we're living our lives. And then we come to Sesshin, and this is a wonderful opportunity to purify body, mind, and heart. And it's a challenge, but it's so precious to be able to return to what I would call sanity. Sanity. You know, and so Zen practice at a Sesshin is like gradually, like dirty water, muddy water, gradually just sitting still, and it naturally filters out. It's like by day 4 or 5, people usually become very clear, very clean minded, just sitting still day after day, hour after hour, and that process is just wonderful to see. You know, by now people are beginning to become clear-minded, clear-hearted. You know, and your body may even, yes, your legs probably still hurt, but when you're not on the cushion, your body probably feels rather good. You know, I got up this morning, my body felt like I was 15 years old. You know, it felt so loose and limber and relaxed. And I have to tell you, it wasn't like that when I came here to Sesshin. It was rather stiff, and by this day in the Sesshin, I feel like I'm 15 years old, you know. So it's just, you know, my first teacher, Genki Roshi, was a Japanese hillbilly. in a certain way. You know. He had many aspects of like a country person. And one of the things he'd like to do was make his own sake, his own rice wine. And he actually drank a lot of sake. I was kind of surprised that an enlightened Buddhist monk would drink so much sake. There was almost no occasion that didn't call for a glass of sake. So actually during a number of sessions, he used to make his own sake, and he would bring a big jar. Traditionally it would have been made in a ceramic jar, but he would bring a very big glass jar of rice wine, unfinished sake. It would just look like rice milk. And he would put it on the altar next to Guanyin and Guanyin. This is true. And every day he'd look up there, and you know, it would get a little, it would start clarifying at the top. And you'd see it. It would be like clear on top and milky, and the clear part would grow every day, and the milky part would shrink. And he would refer to it in his teisho, you know. And he looked lovingly over at the sake. And he'd compare. He'd say, you know, we're sitting here just like the sake. We're getting through it, you know. He said, money can't buy that purity, you know. And that really happened, you know. But he was right, you know. He was right. You know, just sitting for this many days, just calmly, quietly focusing on the mind, on the koan, you know, the natural self begins to emerge, because we're fundamentally Buddha. We have a kind of natural wisdom that we don't always have confidence in. You know, don't always have confidence in. And because our culture and our way of life encourages us not to be in contact with it. And let's face it. I mean, if you can get in contact with your natural wisdom. There's a lot of, you might not even read the newspaper. You know, it becomes rather certain things become unimportant. You might not even watch the news. You know, and actually that would probably be in some ways a good thing. You know, I have friends who are news hounds, you know, like they catch a Morning Edition, then they get All Things, you know, and I myself listen to these too sometimes. You know, you listen to Morning Edition on the way to work, you listen to All Things Considered on the way home, and maybe you catch the BBC, you know, and, you know, basically you think, oh my gosh, you know, this is just... You go away to Sesshin for a week and you come back and you turn it on and you realize, you know, I could have missed a week of news and nothing would have been. You know, occasionally there is an event that affects us personally, but a lot of this is just a... It's actually like a system designed to keep people nervous, you know, and make them distrust themselves. You know, I really believe that the cultural element is very important. You know, my personal feeling is that our culture has many positive achievements, but it's not necessarily a very healthy culture. And when we come here to Sesshin, this is, I think, a healthier culture, you know. We're putting enlightenment, natural wisdom, at the center of our lives for 5 days or 7 days. And it's amazing to see what happens. It's amazing to see the rice chaff settle out, and people's minds get very calm, and often they get very happy. You know, and no particular reason, you know, but actually that calm, untroubled, happy state is a really natural state, you know. You know, people really weren't always, I don't think it's the case that we're sort of hardwired to be frightened and angry all the time. I really don't think that's true. And when you give people a chance, to just calm down, and you limit the number of distractions and obsessions and compulsions, you know, they get to be very nice people rather quickly. And that's just great. On the other hand, you know, there's another side to this, though. You could say, okay, you're absolutely right. I'm not going back, you know. I want to stay at Murray Grove, right? And assuming we could do that, you know, might not be the best thing in a certain way. Because, you know, basically, well, it's an interesting thing. You know, I have friends who fell in love with Zen practice and actually became monks, you know, like living in a monastery. And living in a monastery is not what you think. Perhaps you have a romantic view, right? So you go to the monastery and everybody would be nice and kind and everybody's enlightened. Jaru, I believe this is, I'm remembering this correctly, Jaru invited me to her class once, one of her classes, and a student asked me if monks could fly. Didn't that happen? I think that happened. I'm pretty sure that actually, I think it was Jaru's class, and he actually, if monks, because he had read somewhere that they could, but they only did it when they were by themselves. But the truth is, you know, they can't fly. You know. I think I told him the truth. But the thing is, you know, people have these ideas about, you know, how peaceful and beautiful it would be in a monastery, and actually it's not necessarily like that. I mean, first of all, people in a monastery are mostly confused people, and they have a lot of karmic issues that they have to work through. So it's actually sometimes not much more peaceful than any place else. You know, just as anywhere else you can be in, you know, you can have an interpersonal rivalry with another monk. You can feel unappreciated, unloved. You know, you can feel that somebody who doesn't deserve it is getting promoted and you've been passed over. Believe me, monasteries are full of such dramas, right? And, you know, you might feel somebody's not really practicing deeply and is getting credit for things that he or she doesn't deserve. And there's a lot of just quarreling going on in monasteries. I mean, having been there in a few, it's astounding, really. You think, my God, everybody's come here to get away from this crap, and they've brought it all with them. But actually, that's inevitably so, you know. I mean, you know, in the case of, you know, the Buddha's community, when he organized the Sangha, at one point, all the monks and nuns were fighting so much, he actually left and went and lived out in the hills, you know, because he just couldn't take it anymore. It was like, oh, you guys work it out, you know. And they did. I guess they got it under control. But basically, that actually happened in the life of the Buddha, you know. So monasteries aren't necessarily peaceful places, and they aren't necessarily more conducive to enlightenment than anywhere else. But what really matters is sesshin and daily practice. And of course, when we get together for our daily and weekly practice, you know, that's just as good as in any monastic setting, in my opinion. You know. Also, you know, I don't want to be unkind, because monks are people and nuns are people who have given up their whole lives to practice this way. And they make tremendous sacrifices, and many of them are really deeply, some of them anyway, are really deeply awake. You know, my teacher Genki Roshi did at least 7 sesshin every year of his life since the time he was 14. And he sat constantly, you know, which you can do too in your life. But sometimes monasteries, the people who grow up in the monastic world are a little bit narrow, and they're a little bit, they don't always know very much about the world. So that's a defect. Sometimes they can't help other people because they just don't know much, you know. I think it's better if, you know, lawyers and doctors and business people and scientists practice meditation and come to Sashin, than if they all were, say, to just bag it and live in a monastery. I think that, in a way, this is like the ideal situation. But I also think it's an ideal situation because our obstacles, our karmic obstacles and our problems are really a great help in trying to wake up. Believe it or not, you know, having troubles is actually really good for your practice. This sounds really crazy, but it's true. You know, troubles really force you to practice deeply. And it's like a fertilizer for your lawn. And that sounds trivial, but it's so important. You know, if you live in a setting where you're relatively free from stresses and troubles, it's actually rather hard to wake up. This is why in all the Zen literature you have all these cases of monks and nuns who are practicing for 20 years, you know, or more, and they haven't had an awakening experience. And somebody like Lin Ji is always coming in and going, "You good for nothings," well, that was his style. Right? You know, "You guys eat your meal every day and then you go to sleep on your cushion and you're not getting anywhere, you know, get up, get going," you know. And basically you think, how can that happen? But it's because they didn't have enough to work with. You know, when you have trouble in your life, when you have problems, and you come in to Sesshin and you sit, it's like you're being pursued by the fires of hell. You know what I mean? Yeah? And that's ideal, right? That's like ideal. You know, I used to have, you know, when I was in graduate school, you know, the graduate classes were so, people in my institution, some of them were really nice, but a lot of people could be quite petty, you know, and sort of gossipy and competitive, extremely competitive. And, you know, I always felt at a disadvantage in these competitions. People I was competing with were often better educated than I was, and had really better skills, more talented than I was too. And I didn't know, I mean, I had done a number of jobs. I had moved furniture for the Mayflower Moving Company. I'd been a carpenter, and I had been a cook in a restaurant. And I knew I didn't want to run a restaurant. That was like an incredibly tough job. I mean, running a restaurant is 60-80 hour to open, you know, it's like your life is making food. You know, it's just that's what you're going to do. You live and you die preparing food day in and day out. And I did that for a year, and it's just like, you know, like the, you know, time to make the donuts, the commercial time, and the guy gets up and he has to make the donuts. That's it. You wake up, you go to work, you start preparing for the lunch. You cut up the vegetables for lunch, you make lunch, clean up, you get a little couple hours off in the afternoon, and basically it's dinner. You get home at 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, you go to sleep, you get up 6 days a week for 50 years, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, that I didn't want to do that, you know, and so I thought, well, what's going to become of me? Because I'm not doing very well in graduate school, you know, I don't want to go back to I don't want to move furniture for the Mayflower Company. I don't like to do that. Which I liked, by the way, but when I used to work for Mayflower, they paid $2.50 an hour. Yeah, that's true. That was a long time ago, but that was minimum wage in the United States. So I used to get a paycheck, $80 minus taxes, right? You know, literally, I used to have like, you know, $14 in the bank at any particular time. So I didn't want to do that. So, you know, graduate school seemed like I was hanging by a thread, right? And when I would go to Sesshin, you know, I was just like, get me out of here, you know, get me out of here. And I wanted so much to escape from my troubles. And Sesshin was just wonderful for me because it, you know, I would come back from Sesshin feeling better, more alive, less frightened. But those problems are like our food. We need those problems to grow and open up. And so it's really crucial to sometimes, I think, be out there in the world dealing with all the crap, you know, because this is how, you know, it's our confusion and our fear and our anxiety, our anger, envy. These things are like doors to awakening. And so, you know, Zen practice is about working with these negative energies, these negative influences, and transforming them into enlightenment, one at a time, you know, turning fear into kindness, you know, turning nervousness into energy, and so on. And so this is really essential. So I think we're all in like the ideal situation here at a place like this, because we've got our troubles, we've got our fears, we've got all those problems out there, and now we can turn them into this beautiful awakened mind. You know, and right now many of you are at this point where you can go deep into this. This state of push deep, and if you're still not there, you don't, you know, if you still have a lot of pain in your legs and you're struggling with pain, I know this sounds ridiculous, but you know, just thank your lucky stars for the pain, because believe it or not, pain is another thing we need to wake up. You know, it's absolutely crucial that people have some pain when they sit. Because if you could just sit down on the cushion and be calm and not have any discomfort, you'd never escape from all your petty thoughts. It's like, you know, basically sometimes the pain in my legs when I was training at first would be really just like somebody had slugged me. You know, it's just like I was dazed by pain, you know. And the only thing I could do was just hang on to my breath for dear life. And when you do that, it takes you down into your essential nature. You know, it takes you down into your essential nature. And you just sink down into this consciousness. And when that happens, it's like it's liberation itself, paradise itself. So, you know, not answering your koan is also a very great great blessing, so to speak, great stroke of good luck. You know, you can be struggling with your koan and just so miserable that you can't answer your koan, and you're sitting there thinking, "This is crap. You know, I hate this. You know, this is I'm a loser. I'm a failure. This Zen is a flaw. Blah blah blah." You know, and then you know, you at some point, you might actually just suddenly realize, "Hey, I'm kind of happy, you know. How did that happen, right? Yeah, I'm kind of happy, you know." And if, believe it or not, it's the obstacle that made that moment possible. This is not like philosophy. I'm not trying to say, you know, don't feel bad about your obstacles. This is like a psychological fact that waking up requires obstacles. That's part of what a koan does, is to create an obstacle where there isn't one, right? And basically, show me your face before you were born. You know, that's not a problem people actually worry about. You know what I mean? Right? Now, I'm really worried. If somebody came into your office and said, "I'm really worried, what could my face have been like before I was born?" You know? That's not something people argue about. It's an obstacle that's created, you know. And the create doesn't mean it's not pointing to something real, but that's how we humans encounter this unified, infinite reality, is by creating a blockage or an obstacle. And so it's absolutely important. It's essential to be blocked. And then you have to move through that block, and then when you have the release, you can experience reality. as long as you're not blocked, you just go along with your usual illusions. See? So people can't get out of their illusions simply by thinking. You know, you just can't. You can't become aware of your illusions by thinking, even by wanting to be free from them. You can't get outside the box until you're blocked. And then when you're blocked, you can step into another way of seeing. And it's the blockage that makes that possible. So what I'm saying is, to some degree, everybody's struggling. You're all doing a magnificent job, but everybody's struggling. Some of you are struggling with pain, and some of you are struggling with your koan, the complexity, and you're up against a wall. You can't get through this damn wall. You know, and some of you are struggling with things in your life that are keep emerging on the cushion. This is also purification, and these problems are the door to your awakening. Yeah. And so this is really like a wonderful, wonderful day, right? It's just beautiful. You know, how are you doing today? Well, my legs hurt. I haven't answered my koan, and I'm tired. He said, "That's beautiful. You know, that's the best possible situation." Really and truly. And probably there's a part of you that actually would say, "My legs hurt, I'm tired, I haven't answered my koan, and I feel strangely happy." You know? And that's a little glimpse of enlightenment. That's a little glimpse of enlightenment. So this is like everything's just going beautifully. You all are doing a wonderful job. And even if you haven't answered, quote unquote, answered your koan, please, and I'm not saying don't just forget your koan. Please become obsessed by your koan. In fact, that's absolutely essential. You know, at first you give people a koan like, Samantabhadra rides the elephant, Manjushri rides the lion. What does Buddha ride? People laugh. They think, first of all, you finish the mukong and you think, "Huh, you know, I can handle this one." You know, and it sounds like a joke. It's like this, and then you know, basically, for a while, you think this is funny. But little by little, see, the koan begins to really get under your skin, right? It gets under your skin the same way something in life can get under your skin. You know, you go into your job, and basically, somebody has written an evaluation of your performance, and you think, "Oh well, I don't care what he thinks." But then you go home, and it bothers you for a week. Right? Well, you know, koan's kind of like that. You know, first you think, "Oh, this is just a joke, this koan," but after a while, it begins to get under your skin, and it actually bothers you, right? And that's good. That's good. And let it bother you, please. You know, let it keep you up. That would be great. You know? At some point, you just become obsessed by this koan. It begins to take control of your deeper self, or enters your deeper self. And then, you know, in that complexity, in that, perplexity, and that discomfort, you know, wonderful things can happen. So if you're frustrated, if you haven't answered your koan, if you're struggling with various kinds of karmic obstacles, that's just wonderful. Please keep going. You know, please keep going. That's the door to liberation. You know, if you practice, I don't want to discourage you, but if you practice Zen, that will never stop. It'll never stop. It's not like people have Daikensho, you know. You have Daikensho and boom, all your problems are over. There's so much more to learn. There's so much more to experience. And once you can enter this state deeply. You invent your own koans, right? I mean, because life is full of koans, you know, if you look around. And you're always sitting on the cushion struggling, you know, trying to break into the next level of openness. If you don't do that, I just don't see what the point of life is, really. You know, and there are people who have Daikensho, and they just throw it in the trash. And that may seem impossible, but Daikensho isn't a personal achievement. It's a state of awareness, you know. You can either build your life around it or not. Some people actually don't. You know, they think, well, now I'm enlightened, and you know, well, I don't have to learn anything more. And actually, they can go down the tubes in a way, actually. So, you know, if you love this life, you know, this life of Zen, you don't want it to stop. You just want to go on and on. And so, you know, let's just go on. We have one more beautiful day. We all have our struggles and our hills to walk up. But, you know, if you do it with your whole heart, an open heart and open mind, you'll probably feel wonderful at some point today. And same thing tomorrow. And it could go on and on for as long as you're alive. So let's go on.